Here's a question for book lovers. Is it possible to love books too much? Writer Alison Hoover Bartlett says yes in her new book about book obsession. It's called The Man Who Loved Books Too Much, and it tells the true story of two very different men who are both deeply obsessed with books. One is a prolific thief, the other is the persistent antiquarian book dealer who sent him to jail. NPR's Howard Berkus reports.
The rare book section in Ken Sanders' brick storefront in downtown Salt Lake City feels reverent. Maybe it's the stained glass windows between the stacks. Maybe it's Sanders himself, a man with a long gray and white scraggly beard who tenderly pulls his personal favorite from the shelf.
When I was 14 years old, our grandparents took my little brother and I on a trip to California, and I begged Pop to take me to Bertrand Smith's Acres of Books, 240 Long Beach Boulevard, Long Beach, California. And I bought, not this copy, but I bought this folio edition of Edgar Allan Poe's The Raven, with engravings by Gustave Doré.
Sanders carefully and quietly turns the pages of a treasure, pausing for the lavish illustrations with each verse of Poe's poem. Books have been his passion and profession since that first rare book buy four decades ago.
I would certainly be the last person to deny that I'm obsessed with books. If you want to say I'm obsessed with book thieves as well, I probably won't argue that point either.
One book thief in particular attracted Sanders' laser focus, a polite, solicitous, boyish-looking Californian named John Gilkey. He's the central character in The Man Who Loved Books Too Much, and he admits he stole credit card numbers while working at Saks Fifth Avenue to help finance a book-buying binge. Gilkey was 29 years old in 1997 when he stole his first rare books with bad checks. In her book, Alison Hoover Bartlett sums up Gilkey's obsession this way.
If I had to reduce him to a sentence, I'd say that Gilkey is a man who believes that the ownership of a vast rare book collection would be the ultimate expression of his identity, that any means of getting it would be fair and right, and that once people could see his collection, they would appreciate the man who had built it.
This was a central theme in 3 years of interviews conducted while Gilkey was in and out of prison for kiting checks, violating parole, and stealing rare books.
He told me he wanted to have a fine gentleman's library, and he'd have a big oak desk with a globe on it, and he would wear a smoking jacket. So there's this idea that the world would see him differently, that people would look at his book collection and see that this was a man of culture, an erudite man. And that's really what drove him. It was building this identity for the world.
In a 2005 telephone interview from prison, Gilkey told Bartlett what it was like to first hold a newly acquired rare book. It's a very noisy recording, so listen carefully.
Lately, it's been like a bottle of wine. I kind of smell the newness of the book, and I just feel the crispness of it, make sure there's nothing wrong with it. I open it up very gently. If I'm thinking like maybe 30 years later, this book could be worth something, I don't want to make any mistakes. Preserve the book.
Preserve the book. That's what antiquarian booksellers also want, but Gilkey made that tough for some by using bad checks and stolen credit card numbers to steal their books, about $200,000 worth in 3 years. He focused first on his home territory in the area around San Francisco Bay, and he was unstoppable until he met his obsessive match.
So when people steal from anyone in the trade, Ken Sanders feels an almost personal attack. He's as determined to catch book thieves as Gilkey was in stealing the books.
Sanders once chased a thief out of his own store, smashing the window of the getaway car and getting bloodied in the process. As Gilkey's thefts grew, Sanders became security chair of the Antiquarian Booksellers Association and began chasing down theft reports across the country.
And I became convinced early on of two things. It was the same man or group, because the MOs were just too similar. The second epiphany was these are iconic, valuable books that everybody knows, and they're very distinctive, but I could never find any trace in the marketplace of them resurfacing or being sold. He's a collector. He's a collector that's gone to the dark side.
Bartlett chronicles the cross-country chase as Sanders tracks, identifies, and exposes Gilkey. She probes Gilkey's past, for clues to a life steeped in books and crime, and she documents crime beyond books. But when it comes to books,
he has absolutely no remorse for his crimes. He told me the details of how he went about it, which I describe in the book, but he feels that it was his right to take them.
This is how Gilkey justified the thefts in that 2005 prison phone interview. Remember to listen carefully.
I mean, it's not like 100% I'm wrong. I say it's more like 60% I'm wrong and 40% I'm right. Sure, that's their business, book dealers. But, I mean, they should make it more accessible to people that like books. I mean, that's the kind of a warped thinking I had. How am I supposed to build my collection unless I'm like this multi-millionaire?
This sense of entitlement angers Ken Sanders, who suggests Gilkey isn't really obsessed with books and certainly isn't anything like him.
John Charles Gilkey is nothing but a thief. He's a dirty little book thief. And there's nothing romantic about it. There's nothing noble about him. He might have a passion for books, but his passion is for thievery. As far as I'm concerned, he's the man who loved to steal books too much.
Those books include rare first editions of Jack Kerouac's On the Road, Tennessee Williams' A Streetcar Named Desire, Kay Thompson's Eloise in Paris, and Mark Twain's Life on the Mississippi. And Sanders believes Gilkey is still at it.
A poor woman bookseller in Canada lost a $500 book to a man, John Charles Gilkey, who bounced the check he wrote her for it. I can't escape him.
Even though Sanders is retired from the post of book detective for the Antiquarian Book Dealers, John Gilkey declined to speak with us for this story, but did give permission to use excerpts of his interviews with Alison Bartlett, who says Gilkey certainly enjoys being the subject of a book. She doesn't know whether he has his own copy of The Man Who Loved Books Too Much or how he might have obtained one. Howard Berkus, NPR News.
Over the holidays, two civil rights leaders died. They lived halfway around the world from each other, one in the United States, the other in South Africa. Percy Sutton was a civil rights attorney who represented Malcolm X. He was a political and media figure in New York over the decades. When he started his political life in the 50s, the South was still segregated. In the 1960s, Sutton was arrested as a freedom rider in Mississippi and Alabama. Dennis Brutus was also arrested in the 60s. He shared a prison with Nelson Mandela. Brutus spent his life fighting apartheid as a poet and an activist. Looking back on their lives from our vantage point in 2010, it's easy to see their victories as predestined. Of course, desegregation and the fall of apartheid were a fait accompli. How could society have taken any other course? But in the middle of the last century, these debates were real, intense, and heartfelt. When I was born in the late 70s, civil rights battles were already chapters in textbooks. And even though apartheid still existed when I was a kid, for most of my life there's been consensus about who was on the wrong side of that history. Not just the losing side, but the morally wrong side. There are issues such as abortion that are as contentious today as ever. But civil rights and apartheid seem different, because in retrospect the right answer is just so obvious. As fiery as the debates in Congress were in the 1960s, many lawmakers who voted against civil rights back then have changed their mind and apologized for those votes. It's true that just a few months ago, a Louisiana justice of the peace refused to perform interracial marriages because he thought it was bad for the children. Tell that to President Obama, son of a white mother and a black father. So there may not be complete consensus, but it's close. And now, as we move into a new decade, I look at the fierce, passionate, and heartfelt debates of today, and I wonder which issues that we're debating now will seem morally obvious in just a few decades. Let me say something explicitly. It is easy to interpret this as a veiled argument for some particular policy, whatever your personal favorite might be. And I want to state point blank, I am not trying to make a thinly disguised case for immigration, healthcare, gay marriage, climate change, Afghanistan, or anything else that the country is debating today. I'm asking a sincere question, and I don't know the answer. I don't think anyone can know the answer today. Which controversies of the present day will continue to be debated forever? And which, like civil rights and apartheid, will seem morally obvious by the time we're all just a few decades older. You're listening to NPR News.
Leaving your children, your family, to escape an abusive husband would be a heart-wrenching choice for any mother. Now imagine being a Muslim woman seeking shelter in a foreign country where you have no one and you barely speak the language. NPR's Jamie Terabay reports on a refuge for Muslim women in Baltimore.
Alone yet together, three women gather in a kitchen trying to make the most of another meal away from home.
In Iraq, they don't have high cholesterol, right? This is going to kill us.
It's Mediterranean food.
It's going to kill us. No, see, look, all the of the oil, yes.
Standing a safe enough distance from the splattering oil is Asma Hanif. She's the head of this household. She's talking to a Muslim woman, short, dark hair, originally from Kurdistan. For her safety, we can't give her name. She says she'll never go back to the man she was forced to marry when she was 15 years old.
Me no go back. Me no, never. Right now, I'm really happy. Yeah, I'm happy.
She says her marriage was so bad, her husband's beating so severe, she had no choice but to get out, even if it meant leaving her three children behind. She left without knowing where to go. She slept in her car for a month. Eventually, she bought a plane ticket and somehow ended up at this shelter.
It's very good. It's helping me. This help because food, it's house, you know, it's everything.
Now she's in this cozy kitchen joking with the other women about how differently meatballs are cooked around the world. Another Muslim woman from Chad is frying potatoes and her version of meatballs on the stove. It's a cheery scene that quickly unravels. Suddenly, the Kurdish woman breaks down.
It's okay. You never have to go. I'm here. We're here together. It's okay.
Hanif adjusts her lavender headscarf and takes a deep breath. She hugs the Kurdish woman while they both cry. The women here say the tears flow almost every day. Hanif feels it because she knows firsthand what it's like to be on the street after leaving a home filled with abuse.
One of the main things that I like people to know is that those of us who are here, we're not bums.
It's a sanctuary in more ways than one. This house is an escape. For Muslim women, it's something more, a place where they can live and pray without having their faith questioned too.
My biggest problem was that if you send a Muslim woman to be counseled or in a shelter that's run by Christians, then what the people say is that the reason why you're being beat is because of that religion. We do not want Islam to be the focal point of domestic violence.
Indeed, domestic violence knows no religion. But not all shelters are sensitive to Muslims, Hanif says.
There may be situations such as there would be men that would be there, or maybe there wasn't any place for them to pray, or maybe there was an issue with the food.
Here, people take their shoes off at the door. There's no pork in the kitchen, and a section at the front of the house is marked for prayers.
Sisters have, you know, congregational prayer because, you know, as Muslims, we pray five times a day.
Hanif is a nurse by trade, not a social worker. Running a battered women's shelter wasn't part of her plan. But over the years, she treated dozens of abused Muslim women at a health clinic. One memory sticks out, a woman who came to her with a broken jaw.
One of the Muslim women, and she had her, you know, like, let's say if her jaw was, you know, was wired. And I remember her saying that she, now she could lose some of the weight that she'd been wanting to lose because she had to, you know, suck her food through a straw. And we didn't inquire any more about it. We kind of laughed with her. And yet she had been beaten. And I remember us doing nothing about it at all.
But not long after that, she did. Almost 12 years ago, Hanif set up this home in a residential neighborhood in Baltimore. And she lives here, even though she has three grown children. Hanif is African-American, but most of the women she takes care of are immigrants.
They have nowhere to go. It's like the society doesn't want them. Their family doesn't want them. And the man who beat them doesn't want them.
But helping all these women and hearing their terrible stories has taken a toll on Hanif.
I hear their voices in my head, you know, crying, and it wears on my soul. And I tell people I used to be a happy, go-lucky, smiling person, and now I carry a lot of sorrow.
Hanif says she's not trained to do this, but does it anyway. she does it for the voices of all those women she's been able to help and those she couldn't. Jamie Tarabay, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris. Raw food and molecular gastronomy, low-carb diets and celebrity chefs, just a few of the food fads that were on the menu over the last decade. But come on, what did we really eat in the past 10 years? Not just read about, but actually put on our plates and into our stomachs. For real answers about America's real dietary trends, we turn to Harry Balzer. He's vice president with the NPD Group. That's a consumer marketing research firm. And he specializes in studying what Americans eat, and that's why we're talking to him. Welcome to the program, and Happy New Year.
Well, Happy New Year to you too, Michelle.
So, was there one specific thing that defined the American diet over the last decade?
Well, if there is one that defines this decade, it would have to be yogurt.
Yogurt?
Yogurt would be the category or the food that has increased in our dietary habits more than any other food during the past 10 years.
Color me surprised.
And it probably, if you think about your own behavior, I'll bet you start your day off a lot with yogurt or have it during lunchtime or maybe have it as a dessert or a side dish or as a snack, more than you did probably 10 years ago.
That's true.
One of those things that kind of sneaks up on you, but yeah, I think defines what America's really looking for from its food supply.
Well, now, is it because yogurt is something that's healthy or because it's convenient or because it now comes in all kinds of forms? It's not just in tubs, it's in tubes, it's frozen, it's...
Say yes to all of those. It's very convenient. It's very individualized. You don't get a bunch of yogurt like you get a pizza pie and celebrate with everybody else. This is just for you. It's your own flavor. It has a health halo certainly surrounding it. It really does define what I think America wants from its food supply.
So beyond yogurt, what other shifts have we seen? Are there foods that have surged and others that have disappeared or all but faded away from the menu?
Well, the item that has faded away, and I won't say it's disappeared, it's just not as popular, would be toast. But on the flip side of that, we've been eating more breakfast sandwiches, particularly in our car. Matter of fact, that would probably be one of the other trends that have gone on in this country is the use of drive-through to feed ourselves more and more.
In the morning?
Well, throughout the day, to be honest with you, at lunchtime and the pickup and bringing home from restaurants. That's been a moving trend throughout this decade. Although the one trend that I would say is another one that defined the decade that was unlike the previous five decades, going back to World War II, was the stopping of us using restaurants more. We went for nearly five decades of every decade we could count that Americans would buy more meals at a restaurant at the end of the decade than at the beginning of the decade. But this will be the first decade in my lifetime where this has not occurred.
We have been talking about food, but what about beverages? Was there a drink of the decade?
Oh, the drink of the decade, without a question, and probably identifies what America is or was, is bottled water.
I thought you were going to say coffee.
It's a funny thing. The peak year for coffee consumption in this country was 1946. It's really not been increasing since 1946. Mm. It's been declining, if anything. But what has happened is we've shifted where we get that coffee. The first shift was getting more of it away from home and less likely to have it in home. No, actually, the very first shift was not to end up having coffee at lunch or dinner. There was a time during the 50s and 60s where this country ended its meals with coffee. It's today you just have it at breakfast time.
So you say, though, that the actual beverage of the decade was bottled water. Take me back to the beginning of this decade, the year 2000.
And again, this is probably something that's been going on for more than that, than just this decade, but it is by far the fastest growing beverage. And it was a category that also kind of surprised us. It's certainly not new. We know water. You can only walk away saying the only advantage it must have had was it was convenient. It was convenient to have a beverage always near you that didn't require any other special handling. It didn't have to be hot. It didn't have to be ice cold. It just had to be a liquid. As the decade would progress, we'd find that people found ways of flavoring this thing, making it healthier, adding things to it, so that it really became kind of like what carbonated beverages were to begin with, and that's really the beverage it replaced.
Mr. Balzer, it's New Year's Day, so this is a good opportunity for us to look ahead and perhaps look into your crystal ball and talk a little bit about the trends of the future. What's the next decade hold?
Well, the next decade is much more, it's going to be very difficult to predict, but I will tell you if we talk 10 years from now, we will talk about those things that made our lives easier. That will be the driving force, because that is the long-term trend in eating is who's going to find the new way of preparing the meal for us? Who's going to find the easier way to deliver the food to us? Who's going to find the easier way to clean up the food for us? What won't change is what we eat. I will tell you, the number one food that we will eat in the year 2020 will be a ham sandwich. And I know that because I've been doing this for 30 years, and I was hard-pressed in 1980 to be told, to be asked, what will we be eating in 1990 when I discovered that the ham sandwich was the number one thing we ate in 1980, and I made a prediction that we'd be eating in 1990, and guess what we ate in 1990? A ham sandwich. What do you think it was, 2000? A ham sandwich. 2010? A ham sandwich. So do I have to go out on a limb to tell you that the number one food we'll be eating in this country in the year 2020 will be a ham sandwich? What I don't know is what will be the bread. There'll be something new about the ingredients or the condiments that go on this. But when I ask you, what did you have, you'll say, oh, I had a ham sandwich.
Harry Balzer, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. I think there's a ham sandwich in my future, so I'm going to let you go. Harry Balzer is a vice president with the consumer marketing research firm, the NPD Group. Thanks so much for talking to us, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris. The 2008 presidential campaign was supposed to herald a new era for women in politics. Sarah Palin shot from Alaskan obscurity to the number two spot on the Republican ticket, and she was a big hit at the GOP convention.
I love those hockey moms. You know, they say the difference between a hockey mom and a pit bull? Lipstick.
Republicans thought they had a star, and they did, until she stumbled badly in a series of high-profile interviews. After that, her star began to fade among some voters. On the other side, Hillary Clinton was the overwhelming favorite for the Democratic nomination early on, a surefire bet to make history as the first woman to head a presidential ticket, until a candidate from the south side of Chicago edged her out with his own historic campaign. Despite the close loss, Clinton was optimistic about the future in her concession speech.
And although we weren't able to shatter that highest, hardest glass ceiling this time, thanks to you, it's got about 18 million cracks in it.
But more than a year later, political watchers in both parties have concluded that the proverbial ceiling, even with all those cracks, is still pretty hard to break through. Ann Kornblut spent months chasing Clinton and Palin across the country during their campaigns. She writes about the experience in a new book called Notes from the Cracked Ceiling, Hillary Clinton, Sarah Palin, and What It Will Take for a Woman to Win. I asked Kornblut whether John McCain and the Republican Party had considered how the press and the public would react to a female candidate.
It's worth noting that all of the people who made the decision to put Sarah Palin on the ticket were, of course, men. You had a male campaign manager, a series of very senior men on the McCain campaign, and the candidate himself. I think they failed to take into account that some of the personal criticism that women have faced at much lower levels, you know, running for mayor, for governor, for senator, might actually occur if they put a woman on the ticket. And I think they failed to appreciate the level of excitement that they thought would only be used for the good for them on the ticket, but also can be used for the negative. That certainly was the case in Sarah Palin's case.
You know, I had the experience of actually having my head almost bitten off when I asked about the juggling of family responsibilities while also traveling on a campaign bus by one of the McCain aides. And I know several reporters also had similar experiences. They seemed not to take that into account early on.
They were very unprepared for those kinds of questions, questions that would be unique to women. And in fact, some of this was true for both the Clinton and the Palin campaigns. They both struggled with questions that are unique to women that are to do with gender. In Clinton's case, there were very different questions. It was, what kind of woman are you? Are you feminine enough? But in Sarah Palin's case, the question of, can you be a mother and an office holder? What kind of impact will having a small child and several small children with you be? Was one that they weren't prepared to answer, and they fell back on, that's not a fair question, when in fact women who run for office all over the country know that's something they're going to face. Any woman is going to have to be able to answer these questions even if they don't like them.
I want to turn to Hillary Clinton, where her campaign seemed to make an assumption from the outset that Clinton would appeal to women of all ages, of all stripes, of all backgrounds. That turned out to be a major miscalculation. Why?
It sure did. And in hindsight, it's easy to forget that Hillary Clinton lost women in Iowa and lost big. She actually came in third after John Edwards. And among young women, women under about the age of 30, she was in the teens in terms of her support. But even among older women, the Clinton campaign spent so much time focusing on proving her toughness, talking about the war, talking about national security, because, of course, that had been a traditional weakness for women, something they felt they had to overcome, that they began to lose support among women who were not sure what kind of woman she was, weren't sure she was in touch with her feminine side. And she lost some very prominent women early on in 2007, of course, the most important of which, arguably, was Oprah. Once the campaign evolved, she did begin to pick up steam among women. And by the end of it, especially older women were the core of her support. But early on, that was not necessarily the case.
Why was Hillary Clinton so uncomfortable with emphasizing her gender? Even up to the end, she was removing gender-specific references from her now-famous concession speech. And even that line that where she noted the 18 million cracks in the glass ceiling, that was something that was offered to her by a man. That wasn't a line that she came up with on her own.
That's right. Her speechwriter, Jim Kennedy, inserted that line as he was working on the draft, and it became the most memorable line of the speech. The story of that concession speech is actually fascinating. She had struggled throughout the campaign with this idea of whether she should give a gender speech. Long before Barack Obama gave his heralded speech on race, her campaign had thought about it. Should they talk about it? Should they go to Wellesley? Should they go to Seneca Falls? Should they remind the nation of what it would mean to elect a woman president? Ultimately, they decided not to. They were concerned about turning off male voters. They were worried about emphasizing her gender. She said over and over in the campaign, "I'm not running because I'm a woman." And her aides often said that was just part of her nature, that was part of who she was. And growing up in the time she did, in a time when women in law firms and prominent positions were told not to put pictures of their children in their office because their colleagues might think they were too focused on their families, this had been ingrained in her that you had to prove your toughness as a woman, you had to overcompensate and talk about the substance of your work.
In the end, do you come to the conclusion that a woman candidate for higher office does have a harder road to hoe? That there still are many, many obstacles?
Oh, absolutely. It's hard for anyone to run for office, right? But for women, no one seems to have entirely cracked the code of how to present herself as a woman, what kind of woman she'll be, who will both be taken seriously as an office holder, but also accessible as a person. In Hillary Clinton's case, she learned towards the end of the campaign to keep that balance. But from everyone I've spoken to, it seems that whoever's going to win someday, whatever woman is going to run for president and win, will be the kind of woman who's learned to walk that balance, to be tough but not too tough, to be a woman but not so much of a woman that she's diminished her credentials as a lawmaker.
And before I let you go, I just want to ask you about this wonderful anecdote that you have at the end of the book where you ask Rahm Emanuel, who is now the chief of staff at the White House, what it will take for a woman to run and win. And when you're talking to him, he's fiddling with his BlackBerry. He's having a hard time answering what seems to be a pretty simple question that you put to him. Tell us about that scene and help us understand what it says about the core question that you pose in your book.
Well, I had gone to the White House to interview Rahm Emanuel, mostly about Nancy Pelosi, who I had also interviewed for the book. But I asked him, because he used to be the chief recruiter for the Democrats in the House of candidates, and so I thought he might know some hidden secret out there. I said, you know, what's it going to take? How soon do you think it will be before a woman wins? And he was, frankly, stumped. And it took him a few minutes, and he didn't have an answer. And finally, he said, well, you know, if we could elect Barack Obama, it shouldn't be that hard to find a woman and elect her. But he didn't have a list of names. And as I went around the country asking other people the same question, very few people have a list of names. So while there's a list, there's a few names here and there. I would not at all be surprised if Janet Napolitano someday runs, or Claire McCaskill in Florida, Alex Sink, who's running for governor, might run someday. But really, it's only about a half dozen names that people were able to furnish of women who might run. So when it comes to the practical question of who will it be and when will that happen, I think it might actually be farther away than people think.
Ann Kornblut, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Ann Kornblut. Her book is called Notes from the Cracked Ceiling, Hillary Clinton, Sarah Palin, and What It Will Take for a Woman to Win.